This is the second day of this July 2014 seven-day session. And we'll read from the teachings of Japanese Zen Master Bankei. This is from a book called Bankei Zen by Peter Haskell. These are translations from the record of Bankei. Yesterday we went through his life story, and we'll take up the actual talks now. These are from, we mentioned this yesterday, but I'll just mention it again. When Bankei was 58 years old, this is 1690, he had already become quite well known. And he conducted the most famous of his training periods, a vast kese, sometimes it's called an ango, a three-month training period, attended by nearly 1,700 monks of every sect, every Buddhist sect. And he delivered a total of 60 teishos, and someone recorded them, and that's what we're going to read from here. The master addressed the assembly. Among all you people here today, there's not a single one who's an unenlightened being. Everyone here is a Buddha. So listen carefully. What you all have from your parents innately is the unborn Buddha mind alone. There's nothing else you have innately. This Buddha mind you have from your parents innately is truly unborn and marvelously illuminating. That which is unborn is the Buddha mind. The Buddha mind is unborn and marvelously illuminating. And what's more, with this unborn, everything is perfectly managed. Just a comment about this term, the unborn. This he didn't come up with this term. It's from an earlier, might have been from a sutra, I can't remember now. He certainly, he more than anyone else that I know of, was known for his use of the term, the unborn. And by the way, in each time that word is used in this book, it's capitalized, the unborn. But we'll pretty much read it that way. But just to be clear, he's talking about our true nature, our Buddha mind, our essential nature. And he's talking about mu. And from time to time, I'll just remind people that it's really mu he's talking about, our true nature. Just as he's also talking about talking about it, this. He continues, the actual proof of this unborn, which perfectly manages everything, is that as you're all turned this way, listening to me talk, if out back there's the cawing of crows, the chirping of sparrows, or the rustling of the wind, even though you're not deliberately trying to hear each of these sounds, you recognize and distinguish each one. The voices of the crows and sparrows, the rustling of the wind, you hear them without making any mistake about them. And that's what's called hearing with the unborn. This reminds us of the fact that the Zen school of Buddhism, there are many sects, the Zen sect has always been known as the school, the sect of direct experience, not reading or learning or memorizing so much as just the immediate direct experience of this. Well then, while you're all turned this way, listening to me talk, remember he's addressing 1,700 monks, you don't mistake the chirp of a sparrow out back for the caw of a crow, the sound of a gong for that of a drum, a man's voice for a woman's, an adult's voice for a child's. You clearly recognize and distinguish each sound you hear without making any mistake. That's the marvelously illuminating dynamic function. It's none other than the Buddha mind, unborn and marvelously illuminating, the actual proof of the marvelously illuminating nature of the Buddha mind. Well, there are exceptions to this. For example, when we're doing lots of zazen, such as in Sesshin, where we can mistake the sounds. The most common of these mistakes is when you're first in line in the Doksan line, and every once in a while this happens where the person with the mallet there mistakes the sound of the inking bell here in the Zendo for the my handbell in Doksan. So that's something that if you do that, if you strike the bell and no one comes out of the room, then just shake it off and know that it's one of those things where it's a kind of a makyo, a late Sesshin makyo, where you may hear bells or gongs that no one else hears. These are, of course, the exceptions. His point, I think, is clear to everyone. Everyone who conclusively realizes that what is unborn and marvelously illuminating is truly the Buddha mind, abiding in the unborn Buddha mind, is a living Tathagata, means a Buddha, an enlightened one, from today forever after. Even the word Buddha is just a name given to traces that have arisen. So from the standpoint of the unborn, it's only a secondary matter, a peripheral concern. The person of the unborn abides at the source of all Buddhas, all enlightened ones. That which is unborn is the source of all things, the starting point of all things. There's nothing more original than the unborn, nothing prior to it. There's no question of dying here, so when you abide in the unborn, it's superfluous to speak about the undying too. That's the reason I only talk about the unborn and don't mention the undying. What isn't created can't be destroyed. So since it's unborn, it's obvious it's undying without having to mention it. Isn't that so? Skipping a few pages here. What everyone has from his parents innately is the Buddha mind alone. But since your parents themselves fail to realize this, you become deluded too, and then display this delusion in raising your own children. Everyone involved in bringing up children display every sort of deluded behavior, including stupidity, selfish desire, and the anger of fighting demons. Growing up with deluded people surrounding them, children develop a first-rate set of bad habits, becoming quite proficient at being deluded themselves and turning into unenlightened beings. Originally, when you're born, you're without delusion. But on account of the faults of the people who raise you, someone abiding in the Buddha mind is turned into a first-rate, unenlightened being. This is something I'm sure you all know from your own experience. Your parents didn't give you any delusions whatever when you were born. No bad habits, no selfish desires. But afterward, once you'd come into the world, you picked up all different sorts of delusions, which then developed into bad habits, so that you couldn't help becoming deluded. That which you didn't pick up from outside is the unborn Buddha mind, and here no delusions exist. Since the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, you're able to learn things, even to the point of thoroughly learning all sorts of deluded behavior. At the same time, since it's marvelously illuminating, when you hear this, you'll resolve not to be deluded, and from today on, cease creating delusion. Just as before, you applied yourself skillfully to picking up delusions and made yourself deluded, now you'll use the same skill to listen to this and stop being deluded. That's what a splendid thing the Buddha mind is. Listen and you'll realize the preciousness of Buddha mind. Then, since there's nothing that can take the place of this precious Buddha mind, even if you wanted to be deluded, you wouldn't be able to be anymore. It's because you don't realize the preciousness of Buddha mind that you indulge in self-centeredness, creating delusions that do you harm. Yet those delusions are so precious to you that all of you actually want to become deluded, even at the risk of your own life. Foolish, isn't it? Unable to withstand the base impulses produced by your selfish desires, you become deluded. With all delusions, it's the same. This phrase caught my eye. Yet those delusions are so precious to you that all of you actually want to become deluded. There must be something very precious to us about our thoughts, our delusions, that we cling to them so tenaciously. What could be so precious about them? Maybe it's better to understand their value as giving us a way to avoid the void, avoid what we don't know, and what we don't know can be frightening enough that we'll clutch at. Even in our delusions that are made up of thoughts, we'll clutch at these things as what we know, the familiar, what we've been encased in forever. We'll clutch at that rather than let go of those things just because we're afraid of what is beyond them. On the other side of this world that we know so well, the world of internal commotion in the mind. I think it's all it is. And of course, habit. We're so habituated to trafficking in our thoughts that becomes sort of the path of least resistance. We just keep reflexively going back to our thoughts. We may tell ourselves, well, as bad as they are, as much mischief as they cause us, as much pain as our thoughts cause us, our ruminating and judging ourselves and evaluating ourselves and other people, as much pain as these things cause us, at least they're familiar. They're me, we tell ourselves. They're me. And if we weren't dwelling in these thoughts, who would we be? It's such a painful irony that the very thing that causes us so much misery, our thoughts, is just what we are so conditioned to hang on to. St. Augustine said, "An ill-regulated mind is its own punishment." This thing about hearing sounds like that bird right now that we're hearing, every once in a while someone will ask in Doksan, am I supposed to be hearing, if I'm really absorbed in my practice, whatever it is, am I supposed to be hearing sounds around me or not? And it's a fair question. It comes up, I think, because people experience both ways. You can be absorbed and not be aware of things around you. It's a certain kind of deep state of concentration. Or you can be just as absorbed and be acutely aware of every sound around you. In my experience, I just say to people, don't think either one is right or wrong. It's just, there are two different modes of concentration. You certainly don't want to try to hear everything around you unless that's your practice. There is a practice of just hearing. But very few people do that practice. So you don't want to make that your intention to try to hear things. Your intention instead is to become one with the breath or the koan or whatever it is you're doing. But if you do, in the course of being so concentrated on your breath or koan, if you find that you become acutely aware of sounds, then that's fine, that's wonderful. At the same time, there are references in the Chinese texts, Zen texts, well, there's one where Master said, one who is working on Mu does not see the ground when he lowers his head, nor does he see the sky when he raises his head. The point is, don't get attached to either way. Don't try to effect either of those, but just keep your attention, your mind thoroughly on the practice, not this other thing, secondary. Bhakke continues, everyone insists that the way he likes to behave is his innate character, so he can't do anything about it. He'll never tell you how, actually, he indulges in self-centeredness because of his selfish desires, holding on to those kinds of behavior he likes. Instead, he tries to sound clever and talk about how it's all innate. To falsely accuse your own parents of something you never got from them is terribly unfilial. Is there anyone who's born a drunkard, a gambler, or a thief? Who's born with any sort of vice? No one's born that way. Once you pick up a taste for liquor, it promptly develops into a drinking habit, and then, because of selfish desire, you find yourself unable to stop, without realizing you've become deluded. It's only foolishness, so you've no cause to claim it's innate and pass off the blame on your parents. Well, I don't know. There's modern science has revealed more and more of the role that genetics plays in our behavior. But still, the point is that we can't really we can't blame anyone. That at any moment, our behavior is our responsibility. If we blame our parents, the parents can blame their parents, and their parents can blame their parents, and so forth. It goes all the way back. Let's make this buck stop here. Even if we have a certain propensity towards certain kinds of behavior, whether for genetic or other reasons, still, we're not. There's no such thing as a fixed character. There's no such thing as fixed character. There's no such thing as fixed anything. That's contrary to the Dharma, contrary to the experience of awakening, to think that anything is fixed. Everything is mutable. This word character kind of implies a set condition or set characteristics, but it's misleading that way. It's just like the word I implies that there's a permanent fixed self there, but there's no such thing. And if there's no I, no self, how can there be any fixed character? Yes, there can be strong tendencies, habitual tendencies, and they can be very sobering. But no such thing as fixed anything. Character is mutable, just as everything else is. We can work with that. We are working with it. You come to Sesshin, is there any better way to work on your character than coming to Sesshin? We are change. That is our nature. There's no fixed anything in us. Some things are more persistent about our behavior, our character, some things less so, but whatever. It's just our job is just to roll up our sleeves and just keep redirecting our attention to the practice that we're working on, and then character changes. We don't have to make it a project and decide that we're going to change our character by doing this practice assiduously for years and years and years. Character change happens. And of course, there's a place for will also, which also means won't in matters of conduct. Everyone, do exactly as I'm telling you, and following my instructions, start by trying to abide in the unborn for 30 days. Or, abide in Mu for 30 days. When you learn to abide in the unborn for 30 days, from there on, even if you don't want to, whether you like it or not, you'll just naturally have to abide in the unborn, in Mu. You'll be a success at abiding in the unborn. Since that which is unborn is the Buddha mind, you'll be functioning with the Buddha mind at all times. That way you'll be living Buddhas here today, won't you? So listen to my teaching, just as if today you were all born anew and starting afresh. Which we are, by the way. Every moment we're born anew and starting afresh. because there's no I. When you've got some fixed notion, you won't take in what you hear. Listen as if you were newly born right now, and it will be like hearing my teaching for the first time. If you don't have any fixed notion in your mind, at a single word, you'll instantly understand and attain complete realization of the Dharma. Just a bit more about character. A character, the formation and the change of character begins with thoughts. There's a very famous sequence of steps attributed to the Buddha that goes as follows. Thought manifests as word. Word manifests as deed. Deed develops into habit. Habit hardens into character. Zen practice, some master, Yasutani Roshi maybe, said Zen practice is the practice of purifying character. Just as easily we could say it is the practice of working on our habits. And by habits, don't mean just ordinary habits of smoking or this or that, but habits of thought. Habits of misdirecting our attention, letting the mind wander, lingering in thoughts when we notice the thoughts. These are the habits that we can change, and with it follows character, change in character. And then there are secondary, very important secondary things like whom we associate with. This has a lot to do with our success or failure at working with our habits and our character, is the people around us whom we choose to associate with. That's why associating with a sangha can be so helpful, and getting the support of turning us toward what will not produce pain and away from what will produce pain. It's a huge project we've all undertaken. We need all the help we can get, not just from teacher, but from fellow practitioners. And then he gets more specific here in talking about a notorious thief who would boldly rob people on the highway, seizing their money. He goes into some length describing what a thieving genius this guy was. And one day he got himself nabbed and served a long term in the prison at Osaka. The years passed, and then because he was such an expert as a thief, he was spared execution to become an informer for the police. Later, he was excused from being an informer as well and became a free man. Afterward, he learned to carve Buddha figures. He became a maker of Buddhas, and he settled in Osaka and became an expert now at carving Buddha figures. Completely reversing his former wicked state of mind, he devoted himself to liberation and ended his days absorbed in chanting the Nembutsu. This is a different Buddhist sect, the Pure Land School. So, Bhante tells us, even such a notorious brigand as this guy, he's called the Kappa, once he'd reformed, ended his days in religious devotion. Where can you find anyone who steals because his karma is deep or his sins heavy? Stealing is the karma. If it weren't for stealing, that karma couldn't exist. Whether you steal or whether you don't depends on the present state of your own mind, not on your past karma. And what I'm telling you now doesn't go only for stealing. All delusions are just the same as stealing. Whether you're going to be deluded or not, all depends on the present state of your own mind. This is where meditation is absolutely essential. And in Zen, where the focus is entirely on the present. How are we using the mind right now? What are we directing our mind? This is the whole thrust of Zen practice. In Tibetan Buddhism, there is a lot more of speculation and talk about past lives and future lives. To some people, that may inspire them to practice more rigorously. But in Zen, it all comes down to right here. This is where we have the opportunity to change, is in our present mind. The Buddha supported this understanding when someone was asking about his past life, and he said, if you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at yourself now. This is our work. What's going on in the mind right now? To what degree are we noticing when our attention drifts into thoughts? And once we've noticed, how quickly are we willing to drop it and get back to our practice? That's it. That's the work. Someone asked, everybody says your reverence has the power to read people's minds. Is it true? The master said, in my school, we don't have such extraordinary things. And even if we did, since the Buddha mind is unborn, we wouldn't use them. When I'm speaking to you, I deal with your own selves. So you imagine I've got the power to read people's minds. But I haven't any mind-reading powers. I'm just the same as all of you. When you abide in the unborn, or mu, you're at the source of the supernatural powers of all the Buddhas. And without even having to seek supernatural power, all things are perfectly managed and smoothly dealt with. In the true teaching of the unborn, you can manage everything by dealing with your own self, your own nature, without bringing in all sorts of extraneous matters. This is solidly in the Zen tradition of not monkeying around with psychic powers or paranormal phenomena. A certain man asked, I've practiced as hard as I can, trying to advance without slipping back. But no matter what I do, the tendency to backslide is strong, and there are times when I regress. We can all relate to this report. However much I try to advance, I only fall back again. How can I keep from regressing? The master said, abide in the unborn Buddha mind. When you do, you won't need to bother about advancing or regressing. In fact, when you abide in the unborn, trying to advance is to instantly regress from the place of the unborn. The person of the unborn has nothing to do with advancing or regressing, but always transcends them both. Again, this applicability to mu, one working on mu, has nothing to do. When you're absorbed in mu, there is no such thing as advancing or regressing. You're beyond that. Another way to understand what Bankei refers to as the unborn is samadhi, complete transcendence of all such notions of progress, regress, higher, lower, faster, slower, time. It's all obliterated in a mu samadhi, any samadhi. And that's the irony. One irony after another in Zen is that when you can completely forget anything about progress or regress, that's when you make progress. And yet there's still no progress, even when you're making progress. One day the master addressed the assembly. All delusions, without exception, are created as a result of self-centeredness. When you're free from self-centeredness, delusions won't be produced. So, for example, suppose your neighbors are having a quarrel. If you're not personally involved, you just hear what's going on and don't get angry. Not only do you not get angry, but you can plainly tell the rights and wrongs of the case. It's clear to you as you listen who's right and who's wrong. But let it be something that concerns you personally, and you find yourself getting involved with what the other party says or does, attaching to it and obscuring the marvelously illuminating function of the Buddha mind. Before, you could clearly tell wrong from right, but now, led by self-centeredness, you insist that your own idea of what's right is right, whether it is or not. Becoming angry, you thoughtlessly switch your Buddha mind for a fighting demon, and everyone takes to arguing bitterly with each other. This same passage I found in the other book about Bankei that we read from a little yesterday by Norman Waddell, the translator. And he translates self-partiality. Either way, self-partiality or self-centeredness, these reflexes, and that's what they are, mental reflexes, issue from the belief in a self. That's the underlying problem. Hakuin said it. The root of our suffering is ego delusion. We lose our impartiality, we lose our objectiveness when we're invested in it, in things like this. Well, just to pick a little bit at Bankei, it's not always so easy to tell who's right and who's wrong when your neighbors are having a quarrel. But you're much more likely to get a sense of the situation if it's something you're not, you have no investment in yourself. I would say that really this can be much more broadly understood than just the self. It's anything with which we identify, any group identification, religious identifying with a religion, identifying with an ethnic group, or identifying with a racial group. Any of these forms of tribalism, we could say, were so wired to be tribal. And that's where we lose our clarity, is through our identification with one group or another. You see it playing out all over the world all the time. Right now, most publicly in the flare up again in the conflict between Israel and Palestine. And all of these seemingly intractable religious or ethnic or religious slash ethnic issues. It all comes from when we say the self. That means identification with groups. That's all at bottom. That's the self. It's the my group, my religion, my race, my ethnicity, my sports team. But at the bottom, it's the self. And another word for this problem at base is attachment. There's no reason, there's nothing wrong with identifying with a race or an ethnic group or even a neighborhood. It's when we become attached to that identification that the problems arise. And in his words, because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, the traces of everything you've done are spontaneously reflected. It's when you attach to these reflected traces that you produce delusion. Thoughts don't actually exist in the place where the traces are reflected, and then arise. We retain the things we saw and heard in the past, and when these things come up, they appear as traces and are reflected. Originally, thoughts have no real substance. So if they're reflected, just let them be reflected. If they arise, just let them arise. If they stop, just let them stop. As long as you're not attaching to these reflected traces, delusions won't be produced. So long as you're not attaching to them, you won't be deluded. And then, no matter how many traces are reflected, it will be just as if they weren't reflected at all. Even if 100 or 1,000 thoughts spring up, it will be just the same as if they never arose. It won't be any problem for you. No thoughts to, quote, clear away. No thoughts to, quote, cut off. Again and again, we can't say too often, thoughts are not the problem. There's always going to be some thought activity in the mind. The problem is attaching to them, clinging to them, insisting on holding on to these thoughts, dwelling in them. That's the problem. The thoughts, they come and go. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.